Blog Talk Radio.
Seven feet barren, strange fruit, blood on the leaves, and blood at the roots. Black bodies swinging in the southern breeze. Strange fruit hanging from the poplar trees. Pastoral scene of the gallant South. Them big bulging eyes and the twisted mouth. Scent of magnolia, clean and fresh. Then the sudden smell of burning flesh. Here is a fruit for the crows to pluck. The rain together, for the wind to suck, for the sun to rot, for the leaves.
Welcome to the African Knowledge Beyond the Book Club with your moderator, host, Charles Williams. And I'm joined by my lovely wife from the Wheels of Steel, Jalavette. Say hello, Jalavette.
Hello, Jalavette.
All right. Are you ready for tonight's special feature?
I am ready. This is going to be a very interesting evening. I had an opportunity to look at the works of this gentleman that we're going to be speaking with tonight, and it was a very engulfing type of a read, the type of information that was given in his writings that is so oftentimes left out of the school books and the lessons that we learn about the ancestors. And so I'm looking forward to it.
Yes, yeah, me too. I think I'm almost finished with the book. But tonight we've been featuring slave narratives and the life and the narrative of Frederick Douglass's autobiography. We'll be covering that in the second hour. But the feature for the night is Slaves with Swag, The Negroes Your History Teacher Forgot to Mention by Darryl T. Hinman. And he's here with us tonight to share with us his work he put into the project and to help tell us more about it. Brother Darryl, are you on the line?
Yes, sir. Peace, brother. How you feel?
Oh, peace. How you doing? Thank you for joining us tonight to share your work with us.
Glad to be here. Hello, Jolivet. How you doing?
Hey, how you doing? Thanks for joining us tonight.
My pleasure.
Yes, well, it's an extremely well-documented book. This monograph has so many details and just different. Is broken down the categories of progress and things that our ancestors achieved in these nightmarish circumstances here. Can you tell us how you came into this project and everything? Could you share that with us?
Yes, sir. I grew up in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, and after high school went on to college and got my formal education. But after I was done, while that formal education properly prepared me to compete in the workforce, it didn't give me any knowledge of myself or my ancestry or who I am as an African in America. So from there, brother, I just started, independent reading and research and study. And, kind of what I discovered is that's kind of the only way that we're going to get it. So after about 15 years of reading and, not just black history, but is what I call a history from the black perspective. So the history of all people. Just kind of written from my perspective. After all those years of reading and studying and all the information that I had collected, I figured, if I had been so far along in my education and didn't know these things, who else didn't know? So I figured I'd make it easy for the people and just take the best of the best that I came across and package it all in one book, Slaves of Swag.
Amazing. I really like the way you categorized the the pre-1865 black people, the category 1, 2, and 3. And could you explain or present those ideas to our audience tonight?
Yes, sir. Essentially, what I found that there's kind of three different categories of black people that were living in the United States before 1865. There was the group that we're all kind of familiar with that we learned in our general education, the ones that were severely oppressed, and just held down and slaved, for the slave master out in the field or what have you, from sunup to sundown. We're all familiar with that categorization because we got it, at least the first 12 years in high school, nothing else.
Right.
The middle category kind of is what I call it is those group of slaves who were, while still enslaved, they were less oppressed and still had certain freedoms that they can go about and doing. We can get into that a little bit later. They were still enslaved, but had certain freedoms and actually conducted themselves as free men in many aspects of life. The third group, brother, is pre-1865 black people who were never enslaved. I feel as though this category of our people is probably the most unfamiliar to our people just because of the way, we're all kind of manipulated coming to an automatic assumption of what a pre-1865 black person looks like. But you talked about the details earlier. I tried to back up every single fact that I put forth in the book, and in order to back up that third category, because I know a lot of people probably have a hard time believing it, but I put in the information from the actual census, and a lot of people don't know when the 1860 census was conducted, there was almost 500,000 free black people living in the United States at that point in time.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
I saw that in the sense that you have a facsimile of it in here, where half the African population in America was actually free.
Half a million, brother.
Right. I think
yep.
That was astounding.
Yep.
I can see like the next work you probably working with talking about Africans in the West. You probably go into that too. In that part of it, but in the chapter you think in your second part you moved into like fighting slaves, and this was these were some amazing. I mean, it's like some James Bond type narratives. We didn't imagine some of the like amazing circumstances. Fighting. We read about people mailing themselves, our ancestors mailing themselves, and doing other kinds of. Mm-hmm. But I mean, actually, you know, fighting hands on, you know, getting shot, stabbed, and winning, you know,
yeah,
winning our
it,
freedom.
Absolutely, it gives a totally different perspective of, you know, of our people when you look at it from that angle. You know, we're used to kind of, you know, hat in hand and looking down at the floor and, you know, yes, boss, this, that, the other. But that wasn't always the case. And, you know, if you really think about it, a lot of times, if you sit down and ask yourself, and I know which a lot of folks do, you know, if I was a slave, what would I do in that situation? And, I mean, a lot of people that I talk to, and I know me myself, is I'm going to fight. I'm not just going to sit back and let somebody, you know, whip me or whip my mother or whoever is going to be a confrontation. And that
right.
feeling that we all kind of have, it didn't just come out of thin air, right? It was passed down to us in our blood, and that's because the folks back then actually said and did that. I mean, it just, if you think about it, it just makes sense if you really sit and think about it.
Right. I mean, we know there are many rebellions and uprisings, which is the reason why they tried to they would try to be as brutal as possible to try to maintain as much submission as they can with, you know. But the fact of the matter is that there was still rebellions. There was still, I mean, Ferdows even talked about beating up one of his somebody who he was at this they had a special training farm, and he beat the man. The same guy that hit him over the head with a wooden axe handle and split his skull, but he got him back, you know.
Yep.
And these brothers here. My favorite one was about people. They were burying, they were storing armaments in grave sites. I love that one. Man, we had so much game.
Yes, it's ingenuity. I mean, and you know that same ingenuity in us carries on right today. And I mean, I believe that situation happened in Delaware. I guess just to give the people background. The enslavers had noticed that the slaves was having, you know, a whole bunch of funerals for slaves, but when they look around and kind of did an account, they're like, well, who are these funerals for? Because, you know, all of our slaves are accounted for. So they said something must be up. So when they went out to the graves to dig up and see, you know, whose slaves was actually in those graves, they didn't find bodies in there. They found weapons where the slaves were kind of collecting all the weapons, getting ready for a rebellion.
Right. I mean, we was always on it. I mean, I'm here in Louisiana, I understand, the largest slave revolt, African insurrection happened here in this state.
Quite a few of them happened down there. I like the individual ones that took down. In one article I had, it was happening in Terrebonne, Louisiana.
Mm-hmm.
And again, you know, it was just a prime example where it said the overseer had, you know, kind of slightly corrected a slave. And, you know, he had already put in his mind up that he wasn't having it. And he went back and got that, you know, a similar wooden lever, probably the Frederick Douglass guy hit with, and struck that overseer on the back of the neck with that wooden lever, and the overseer died.
Right.
And, you know, he didn't say, you know, he went running scared or anything like that. And if I can read from the article, and I got this information from an article that was published in a December 17, 1842 newspaper article out the New York Spectator. And he said, after he murdered him in revenge, he sought the sheriff, confessed his crime, and said that he wished to be punished immediately. So, I mean, it just gives a totally different perception of these brothers and sisters, and it gives you it lets you know that they had a sense of manhood and humanity about them that we didn't necessarily get in the school curriculum.
Mm-hmm.
Hey, and while I was dismayed by him surrendering himself, there were many that did not do that.
That's true. Very true.
You know, I mean, and I like to add, do you think that we still maintain, I mean, after reading this genre of slave narratives and your work, which, you know, delves deeper into the lives of many people who were overlooked by contemporary historians, would you say, I just mean, you know, personally, would you say that we still have that level of, I would say, dedication to sovereignty and or freedom that you see displayed in these articles and whatnot?
Yes, I believe so. And the reason I believe it is, if before I did my research, I would not have believed that they had it. But, you know, I kind of had to go out and find for myself, because although the information is out there, it's not promoted.
Mm-hmm.
So the same way that their stories, you know, of when they had their, you know, sovereign moments and you know, their men conducted themselves as men, their stories weren't promoted. I feel as though it's a similar situation with our generation where, you know, we're out here, we exist, but we're just not promoted because, you know, we don't have any sexy. It's not attractive to the masses. It's not going to make, our stories aren't necessarily going to make anybody any money, like, you know, the negative stories that you had on the news, which allows them to sell more, you know, commercial time, which allows them to make money. So, yes, I do believe that we have that. I just believe that it's not promoted the way it should be because it's, I mean, you know, it's, like I said, it's just nothing sexy about a brother who gets up every day, you know, goes to work, come home, take care of his family, take care of his bills. You know, is that protector and provider. Is they can make more money off of, you know, the brother, you know, on the street or on the corner or committing a crime, et cetera, et cetera.
Interesting. The reason why I say that is I thought about modern the media today. We have so much television and we have all these, you know, internet now. And the proliferation of negative images of African people in America are just, you know, all over the place, that perhaps we've saturated our collective, you know, awareness of all this negativity. Do you think we may have become conditioned by it to not really, like, be turned on, like you said, nothing sexy about this brother that's doing, you know, righteous thing. So, you think our society has had its appetite, you know, media appetite, that is, you know, changed? Like I said, we out there, we, you know, we see there's people doing the work, but for the rest of people, not really like feeling it so much because they've been turned out by modern media. You think that may be a contributing factor to the lack of appeal for it?
I mean, definitely. And, I mean, it comes to a situation where when it comes down to it, it's up to us to kind of promote our own stories, which is why, you know, I kind of put the book together to make sure that these brothers and sisters, that their names kind of get reverberated, you know, throughout time, because their stories deserve to be documented and it deserves to be promoted for generations and generations to come. And it's some brothers, you know, that's in our generation and sisters, who can't forget them, in our generation that deserve the same thing. And when it, at the end of the day, it's up to us to promote them. So that's why whenever I come across any of that, you know, negativity in the news or wherever, you see a lot of people kind of reposting it on Facebook, I don't get into all that. I don't promote any kind of negativity about my people. I just promote the positive because there's enough people already are doing the negative thing.
Exactly. I agree. I mean, reason why we have programs like this one and we promote works like yours, because I think that it's, you know, what we need to pay our attention to.
Absolute fantastic program, brother. I'm glad you do it. I mean, and, you know, again, nobody's going to, you know, no news person is going to come to you and say, hey, you know, this brother C. Wills, you know, he got this good program together. They can't make any money off that. Not that you don't deserve to be promoted, because you absolutely do, and all your efforts deserve to be applauded. And, like, again, it's up to us to do that.
Right, right. We have to do it for ourselves, and we have to, you know, we have to get into it, you know. We need to buy books, you know, buy you and your publication company, and support the publication house that, you know, produce works that you produce, and your colleagues in that company. And in the next section, I'd like to, you know, talk about the educated slaves. I mean, I read some article that, you know, about educated slaves in Spanish speaking countries. They had finished college and, you know, had, you know, college degrees, and but I didn't know about it in the United States. Now you presented this very well and documented the higher level of education of people in the West. Could you share some more you know, highlights about that?
Yep, absolutely. And again, you know, a lot of things, even when I kind of went about and started writing the book, is just, some of it, after I really sat and thought about it, I'm like, some of this stuff was just plain old common sense.
Mm-hmm.
So when the government writes, you know, kind of any kind of law against anything, it's because, you know, that behavior is kind of out there in the society and is creating, you know, a perceived issue.
Right.
So the simple fact that, you know, every state, or just about every state, at least all the southern states anyway, created laws, you know, preventing slaves to learn how to read and write, you know, that lets you know right there that slaves is already out there reading and writing.
Exactly.
I mean, otherwise they wouldn't have bothered writing the law if it wasn't taking place.
Right. Right.
And again, you know, back to the documentation, the first thing that I try to provide to let people know that slaves are reading, not only were they reading and writing, but their enslavers knew that they were reading and writing, is, you know, some of the advertisements for runaway slaves, where, you know, the slave owners or the enslavers or whatever you want to call them, you know, they would kind of give a description of the man or the woman who ran away, you know, what they looked like, what they had on. And in those descriptions, they would say, you know, is able to read and write, you know, can speak plain and clearly. And, of course, there was even one instance in there where I guess the enslaver had described where the one slave had written a note for one of his friends who had slaved previously, saying that, you know, this man was a free man, had served his time rightfully and fully, and, you know, basically let him go about his business. And, you know, if he wrote that man a note, that he wrote himself a note.
Exactly.
I mean, it's just common sense. And, I mean, and that's just on a basic level. On some of the more complex level, the one brother that I always like to refer to, I got him at the top of the star on the front of the cover of the book, is William J. Simmons, who, you know, was born a slave down in Charleston, South Carolina. He escaped up to Philadelphia, eventually ended up in New Jersey. And before it was all said and done, you know, he went and he got a bachelor's degree from Howard and a master's from Howard. And he was conferred a Doctor of Divinity by Wilberforce University.
Mm-hmm.
And he took all this education and he became the president of a college in Kentucky, in Louisville, Kentucky. That college was initially named the Kentucky State University, but after his tenure was over, he had done so much for the growth and the progress of the school that they renamed the school after him.
Mm-hmm.
The school is still in existence today in Kentucky, and it's called the Simmons College of Kentucky, named after Dr. William J. Simmons, former slave.
That's right. That's right. I'm looking at it right now.
There's more. You know, John Oliver Crosby, he was also a slave. He was born in South Carolina. And after he went and got himself educated, he ended up being the first president of North Carolina A&T.
Right.
So it's countless cases. I'm sure, like, just down there on the campus of A&T, that some buildings are named after Crosby, Crosby Hall, or Crosby Gymnasium. And,
right.
You know, I'm hoping that the institution is teaching the students that the man that these places are named after, because their stories are important.
Right, they are important, and we just only hope, because I graduated from Southern University, and they didn't, you know, they didn't teach us about these figures and, you know, who are these names meant. I think they were there. It was up on us to figure it out. I mean, there were plaques on the wall, and you would just have to, while you're hanging around the building, you just stop and read it, you know. I would read the monuments or something, and we had seminars where they would kind of talk about it, you know, and most people went to sleep or whatever. But I paid attention to a little of that, enough to realize the significance and importance of the people who came together, walked off the plantations, and they were actually making bricks, you know, and actually building the school land granted by black legislators who had won the elections during the Reconstruction era. And they made a way for our people to have money and have schools. That's why we have historically black colleges and universities. It's because of the work that our ancestors laid down between 1866 and 1900 and beyond. But most that was like the period when it was really booming, and we got to preserve that heritage, you know. And with the work what you've done by documenting it, particularly in this chapter on educated slaves, is how we built it all from the ground up, and we got to hold it down, keep it going.
Yes, sir, absolutely. And it's you know, it passes on from generation to generation, and, you know, it's our turn to do that. So that's why, if you look at my bibliography, a lot of my references are, of the period they were written. You know, everything is probably 1918 and prior, you know, going back to even 1779.
Right.
And, you know, essentially I came across this information, I kind of equated to, you know, you're walking down the street and you see a $20 bill laying on the ground. You know, nobody
mm-hmm.
necessarily points it out to anybody, but, you know, it's sitting down there, it's sparkling and it's worth something, and it's up to you to pick it up and put it in your pocket. So all this information that was in all these old books is out there, and, you know, I was just lucky enough to happen to come across them, read them, and, you know, kind of had the resources to re-promote them. And hopefully, you know, 100 years from now, somebody will come across, you know, my dusty old book laying on the ground and, you know, pick it up and pay it forward.
Right. And put it back in print.
Yes, sir.
Right. I mean, that's what we got to do. We have to. I mean, a lot of us, we think that, I don't know, maybe if you run into this yourself, but you tell me if you have, where some people, I believe, they seem that they went through their formal education and they think that that is finished. you know.
Right. Yeah.
And right, yep. And that's only after you allegedly completed that you realize your education is now just beginning.
Mm-hmm.
You have to say
that. Yeah, and I mean, you never finish learning, and that's why, you know, something I call the difference between it's a huge difference between intelligence and, you know, being educated. You know, you can have an educated person who's relatively unintelligent, but then, you know, you also have an unintelligent person who goes out to get his education. But the person who kind of is able to have both of those is the most successful. And you have to realize that no matter what, you know, the schools teach you, you can always learn from other people. You can learn from, you know, the wino on the street. You can learn from, you know, a supervisor that you have, from your grandparents. You can learn from, you know, your nieces and nephews. You're always learning until the day that you check out of here.
Right. That's right. And, you know, we have to realize that our education is really important, and we have to use that education that we give ourselves, hopefully it's the right kind, the kind that makes us want freedom and sovereignty. And then we can use our resources that we have to further those goals. Like, and when that's interesting, like in your chapter on slaves with freedom and money, how people, particularly Denmark Vesey, you know, his story was so amazing, how he won the lottery, you know. And instead of, like, people today would just go out and buy a lot of, you know, material things just to, you know, entertain themselves. And you could, you know, share with us what this man did with his newfound wealth.
Absolutely. Now, Denmark, I consider him one of those Category 2 slaves because,
okay,
you know, although he was a slave, he did have the freedom to go out and, like you said, play the lottery. And, you know, this is not something that I'm making up. I try to document everything I put down. I went back and found the actual newspaper articles that, you know, reported on Denmark that documented the lottery that he played, how much he won. Now, once this man won this money, and is also is documented in that old newspaper article, he took $600 of that money, went, approached his master, and said, I want to purchase myself from you. How much money is it going to cost? $600? Peeled off $600. Here you go. Give me my papers. I'm a free man, right? It's a phenomenal story. If you sit and think about it, because the way you were taught, you would have thought, number one, ain't no way that a slave is playing anybody's lottery.
Right.
Number
we think
two,
he ain't got no money.
Yeah, right. Yeah, exactly. Don't got no money. He don't got no business out there. All he do is get up, go pick cotton, then you come home, eat some slop, you know, lay on the dirt floor, get up in the morning, and do it all over again.
Right.
So that concept is totally foreign to the general population.
Right.
Number two, not only did he play, he won it. And when he won it, you would have thought, based on your general education, that, you know, the slave master would have took that money for him, you know, pocketed that money for himself. Say, Denmark,
mm-hmm.
you know, you get out there and you keep on working. Not the case. He kept his money for himself, took a piece of it, purchased his freedom. Now, after he earned his freedom, he didn't just leave. He could have easily left and went, you know, north or to Canada or whatever, but he did not. He stayed there, and after 22 years of, I guess, sitting around and observing, he came up with a plot to free his still enslaved brothers and sisters. Now, that's a powerful statement. He could have easily, he was wealthy.
Right.
He had money. He could have went about his business, no problem, and said, you know, I got mine. Hope y'all get yours. Peace to you later. Didn't say
right.
that. Stayed back, formed a plot to revolt. And, you know, and of course, you know, he had some success, wasn't totally successful for various reasons. And ultimately, he paid the ultimate price for it, which was his life. But the positive of that story is how this man didn't just leave. He stood around, stayed back, and gave back to his people. And you make an excellent point, brother. You know, how many folks today, if you hit the lottery, you know, you're going to go out, buy a Mercedes, a house, a car, or whatever. And it's just that ability or that feeling and that trust in your people to go back and give back like that, it just deserves to be promoted.
Right. I mean, we got to promote that kind of image because, you know, how many people in our community, they hit the lottery, if you will, in their occupation or their career. They get,
yeah.
you know, a contract to, you know, their business blows up or, you know, or they become a professional entertainer where they're making a lot of money. And, I mean, how often we see them They may be giving token gifts to the community, some turkey dinners or something. Demog didn't do that. He didn't say, here, here's a chicken for everybody, you know.
No, he did.
I'm trying to get
gave his life.
Right, he gave his life. He's trying to get you free.
Yeah.
It's something you really need, you know what I'm saying? You need this more than need what I could give you and be a hero. He could have did, gave you little gifts, and people been singing songs about him.
You're so right. And, I mean, that's
right.
An excellent example, and I'm glad you made that comparison where, you know, it's not just the lottery, but it could be, you know, your job, a career, contract, et cetera. Excellent example, brother.
Yes.
And I mean, there's one more example that I want to provide of that as a man, a slave, John Barry Meacham. He was born May 3rd, 1789, in a place called Goochland County, Virginia. This man, he said, he wrote a book, and the title of his book was An Address to All the Colored Citizens of the United States.
All right.
On the first few pages of that book, he clearly states, I love my master. He said, but my master's getting old. And when he dies, I don't want to be sold off to somebody else who may end up mistreating me. So what this man did, John Barry Meacham, he approached his master, said, look, I got love for you, but, you know, let's be realistic here. You're coming to the end of your life. I don't want to be sold off to somebody else. I want to purchase my freedom from you.
There you go.
And the master says, okay. John Barry, he completes his slave duties during the day. He basically gets a part-time job working in a mine, earns enough money to purchase his freedom, pays that money to his master, and he has his freedom. Boom, gone. So same situation. He got his freedom. He got his. He could have easily just started working full-time in the mine, took his money, did whatever he wanted. Didn't do that.
Right.
He did continue to work, made money. He went back to Virginia and purchased his father. He had a wife and a daughter. He went back, purchased the wife and the daughter. And this man went back and purchased 20 other slaves.
Wow.
Not non-related. Just went back and said, look, I'm going to purchase your freedom for you. All you have to just give me your word that you're going to pay me back once I set you free. And all of them said, yes, I'll give you my word. And they said, every last single one of them paid him back except for one who ended up being an alcoholic. Now, the other thing that this man did, and it's documented in his book, and there's also various newspaper articles on him to document it. He ended up in St. Louis. In St. Louis, he had a church. He ended up being a reverend. He had a school in the basement of his church where he taught slaves how to read and write. The state of Missouri came to him and said, no, John Barry, you're not allowed to do that. You know, you're not allowed to teach any slaves in our state, in our great state of Missouri. So what this man did was he took some of the money that he had a ship built, floated the ship out in the Mississippi River, and set up school on a ship because the Mississippi River was federal property and didn't belong to the state of Missouri, and the administrators of the state of Missouri couldn't mess with them out there.
There you go.
You can't make this stuff up. And the fact that this man took the time after all that to write a book to document his story and also give instruction to other black folks on, you know, how to go about attaining their freedom and, you know, taking advantage of the American dream is just phenomenal. It's phenomenal. And again, it deserves to be promoted. He should be in the curriculum. You know, he should have a picture of him instead of Abraham Lincoln up in you know, every black house in the United States. But, you know, sadly, not that many people know about him, but we're going to help correct that.
Exactly. I mean, just look at the kind of personality profiles that are being sold to us. And I'm willing to say they come from a specific clique of or type of African that we say who's approved. Now one person I have to mention who was kind of different, which I've been, you know, amazed. I went to Booker Washington High School. And Booker T. Washington High School was, you know, described, you read Ralph Ellison or you know, listen about it, how, you know, he was just, you know, he's a half white, you know, black man, and he's living in Alabama trying to make a living. He comes out of slavery, builds a magnificent university, a college institute, actually, at the time. And then, you know, the end, but when I started realizing that how he was working closely with Marcus Garvey to really create some real political power for our people. That was mind-boggling to me, and I see why he was so fiercely opposed by the talented 10th clique, and we don't hear about the like the people you've profiled in your book, as well as the other side that the people of say an approved black figure like Booker Washington, and we don't hear about how he was trying to create economic power for our people. We don't know that. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I absolutely do. And one thing about Booker T that I learned, I read a book titled Noted Negro Women, written by a black medical doctor out of Waco, Texas, Monroe. Doctor, I believe is Monroe, Alphys Monroe.
Okay.
In his book, he highlights the lives of, you know, noted, basically noted African American women. One of those women in the book is a Davidson Washington. I can't remember her first name, but her maiden name was Davidson, and her last name was Washington. And she was Booker T. Washington's wife. Mm-hmm. And before she was his wife, you know, she went to school. She went to Hampton, got educated. She always took the time out to educate the slaves. So she ended up, after she graduated from an institution, she went down to go work with Booker T. Now, her job, initially she was brought on as a teacher, but eventually what she ended up doing was going back and forth to Boston to help basically raise funds for Booker T to finish building Tuskegee. And it was her trips back and forth to Boston and et cetera where she helped to finance the institution. And
wow.
Some of the articles and things that I came across, they were calling her the co-founder of Tuskegee because essentially she went out and raised the money. My first name is Olivia. Olivia Davidson Washington.
Awesome. I never knew that. But that was, she actually was the, you know, was the person who did the, you know, the fundraising. And
absolutely.
And we don't know, a lot of us, we really don't know. And we're being sold out on celebrities now. It's like now it's moving to a new strata. And we didn't know about, you know, like I just, you know, it's just, it's, we don't know about these things. And we should. And I think it's going to come, like I said, on us. We have to buy these, we have to buy your book. We, it's our job to do that. We got to know about it. We have to buy it. We have to read it, not just buy it and just sit around and look at it and say, hey, I bought this nice book. I'm really progressive. We actually got to read the book.
Yes, sir. And the same thing goes along with listening to your program. Same thing. Because if it's going to be done, it's going to be done by us is essentially what it comes down to. I mean, you know, you hate to say it, but that's just the reality of the situation. There's no point sitting and, you know, crying over spilled milk and, you know, these people are against us or this, that. We just got to go out and make it happen.
Exactly. And exactly. We, it's our job and it's our call to do it. If anybody want to call in and ask a question of Brother Darrell Hemman, the call-in number is area code 323-580-5707. I think we could take a short break.
Okay.
And we'll be right back with the author of Slaves with Swag, Darrell T. Hemman. We'll be right back. To Love in Black with Charles and Jolivet on the Tribal Family Station on blogtalkradio.com.
There we will share our experiences and our insights on marriage and love, sex, respect, and honor. We're on every Thursday evening on the Tribal Family Station. Song Community Experience is an extension of the Woman's Song Facebook community. Woman's Song was created with the mission to promote sisterhood and solidarity amongst women of color the world over. The Community Experience radio broadcast is an outreach effort to bring lecturers, authors, healers, spiritualists, and others with the necessary information to assist us in our campaign to repair ourselves. Our community is in dire need of reformation. During this Renaissance period of awareness, we will honor the womb man, and we seek to bridge the gap of understanding, love, and the upliftment of our sisters in crisis. Will you join us? We need your help in bringing this new awakening to all who desire its enlightenment. Become a part of our commitment to elevation as we work together to lift the divine earth to their rightful places. Woman Song. She's singing.
Welcome to AfricanImpressions.com. African Impressions is a Black-owned business that offers products made by the global African community. African Impressions offers the finest in African-made jewelry, craft, clothing, and so much more. As the renaissance of the African community rapidly approaches, you need to add acquiring products crafted by members of the global African family to your repertoire of activities. We must rediscover more of our ancient cultural habits, which we struggle to regain, and incorporate them into our daily lives. Support African craftsmen and women by shopping at AfricanImpressions.com today. Hope to see you there. Join us for the sweetest show on internet radio, Honey Soul Radio, every Tuesday evening, 7 p.m. Pacific, 9 p.m. Central, and 10 p.m. Eastern. Join your hostess, the Honey Diva, and Miss Lady P. Every Tuesday evening, 7 p.m. Pacific, 9 p.m. Central, and 10 p.m. Eastern. Honey Soul Radio on blogtopradio.com. Now add a little honey to your flavor.
Greetings, I'm Eric Teamer, host of Common Sense Conversations. Join me every Tuesday and Friday when I put common sense where it ain't so common. That's Common Sense Conversations, every Tuesday and Friday, 6:30 Eastern, 5:30 Central, 3:30 Pacific. Common Sense Conversations on blogtalkradio.com.
Black in public, black out loud, and black on purpose. For some, it's where your deprogramming begins, and it's where others on the path come for fellowship. Come on in and kick your shoes off. Visit us at www.facebook.com/blackinpublic. Put your fist in the air, y'all, because we're going to keep it black.
Listen in to African Conversations on the African Knowledge Network, where we will converse with researchers about matters significant to the African diaspora community. Join us on Facebook on the African Conversations community page. Enjoy the dialogue on African Conversations on blogtalkradio.com.
African Knowledge Beyond the Book appears every Wednesday night at 10 p.m. Central Standard Time. We are a literary society dedicated to the study of African-based psychoanalytical texts. We hope you will join us as we delve into the inner working of our African consciousness. African Knowledge Beyond the Book, every Wednesday night at 10 p.m. Central Standard Time on blogtalkradio.com.
Welcome back to African Knowledge Beyond the Book. Tonight we have a special feature, Slaves with Swag, The Negro is Your History Teacher Forgot to Mention by Darrell T. Hinman. And he's with us tonight to share with us his insights and how he came up with this astounding work. Welcome back, Brother Darrell. How are you?
Fantastic, brother. How are you?
Great. I'm doing well. I think, Jonathan, do you have any questions or anything? Hello?
Yes, I'm here.
Yes, I'm right here. I'm sorry. My mic was out. I was just saying that, yeah, I do have a couple of questions. The conversation was just so riveting, and I didn't want to just butt in, but I had a question way back in the beginning for you. I wonder, where did you come up with the name for this work? I've heard so many different stories surrounding swag and what that means and this kind of thing. So can you tell me what it is or what your intentions were when you chose that name for this project?
Part of the name, you know, when you're speaking to a people, whoever that people may be, you have to speak their language in order to communicate with them. So I try to pick my words carefully in order to appeal to, you know, my generation and definitely the generation behind me. So the term swag, you know, and I sit there and I struggle for a while for the right term. I definitely wanted slaves in the term because that's, you know, well known, and that's, I wanted to kind of correct the perception that's associated with that word. So I had to put that word in there. And then the swag piece, really when I thought about the slaves and some of the things that they did to take yourself from, you know, having nothing, no education, you know, a lot of them did have their parents around, but, you know, just you're having your identity stripped down to nothing in terms of, like, who you were in terms of an African, and to start from nothing, mm-hmm. and to build yourself back up in, you know, essentially a foreign country, and for some of the brothers who went and approach their masters and say, I want to buy my freedom, to me, you have to have a certain level of confidence, you know what I mean? Like, your shoulders have to be fat, with your feet planted. And to me, the word swag just epitomized just some of the actions that these brothers and sisters took. So, I mean, once I hit the word, it was relevant to the younger generation. It gave adequate description to what these people actually did, and I was good with it. A lot of people, I think, take issue with it because they see the title and they say slaves are swag, and they still got that negative perception of, you know, of a slave being, you know, no shirt on, no shoes on, you know, pants all ripped up, and, you know, just kind of slaving and singing in the middle of a field all day. If you try to think of the title in reference to that picture of a slave, you know, I can see where you would have a conflict. But once you read the book, there shouldn't be any question at all whether or not these men and women had swag.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and then I wanted to know, you kind of, I guess, you know, touched on this when Charles asked earlier, but I wanted to ask specifically about the attitude that you were just speaking of, the attitude of approaching our freedom and what that meant to us as a community, as a generation, I guess, on a larger scale is what I'm trying to say. Do you see that type of innovation, that type of drive still present in our community today?
Yes, I do. I believe that kind of our struggle for civil rights, I believe for the most part we have civil rights. You know, there's always going to be instances of, you know, you're coming across certain individuals, you know, like with the Trayvon Martin situation, where, you know, the civil rights are violated, but I think on a whole, we have civil rights. I think the fight of our generation is to basically attain mental equality. And to me, part of that mental equality is going to come from the correction of the historical perspective of our people, which is why my focus is on history, because you have to. I kind of put it in terms of, if you have a tree, and you know you plant that tree, you don't plant that tree upright. You kind of plant it as on a slant, and you know you stake it on a slant. That tree, you know, 200 years later is going to be on a slant. There's nothing you can do to correct it, to kind of straighten it out. So I kind of equate that to the way we were kind of taught the history of ourselves. It's kind of taught as a slant. So you can sit there and struggle and try to make that tree erect, or you can just plant a whole new tree, which is really what I'm trying to do with the documentation of our history in Slaves of Swag.
Okay.
And to me, that has to be the approach.
When I look at, like, the example that was given about the slaves that had the mock funerals when they were actually stockpiling, you know, the proper weapons and ammunition for, and, you know, insurgency. Now, this kind of thing, you know, you don't talk about that on Facebook or on Blog Talk Radio, right? But what I guess my main disagreement with you is that there's a certain energy, or we can call it an attitude, we can call it a presence, a knowing. When you come across people who seek to right the wrong above all else, at all costs, and I think that through these, you know, the quote-unquote civil rights and various other pacifiers that we've been given, I think that a lot of our fight, that fire has been extinguished, I think. And that's what I was asking, your opinion on that.
I guess being in my position, I guess, as a, you know, kind of a pseudo educator with the information I provide in the book, I have to refuse to believe that passion has been extinguished.
Okay.
I guess in order for me to even have the drive and desire to package the information in the book, especially for the younger generation behind us. All I can do is hope and wish is there, you know, and the fact that just believe that it's there, that it's just not being promoted. The same way I had the belief in my gut told me that the stories of these pre-1865 blacks were there, but, you know, just didn't have the details of it.
Right. Okay. So you're saying that it's there, because you remember I said in the beginning that maybe, you know, we're not in a situation now. We actually have less freedom now, in my opinion. And so we can't just talk about that and just pass the word. You know, it has to be passed clandestinely, and I understand that. But I was just talking about the attitude or the energy, the feel of some of my brothers and sisters, and I am saddened, and I think that works like yours can help to fuel that passion again, I think. I think it's very relevant, understanding our history and understanding our capabilities, retuning our minds and our thinking, that we might be able to, you know, reapproach that kind of thinking, using those types of maneuvers to get free.
I absolutely appreciate that, and again, that's my hope that it's there. And you know, it's always up to the next generation to kind of, you know, pick up the ball and keep it moving, so to speak.
Right. Well, all right. That's all I have.
Right. That was great. I mean, this work right here will remind people that, you know, we have done a lot. And one thing, because in that, I mean, you can find a books on each of these subjects, but this one it introduces the reader into, you know, the various enterprises that we were engaged in under the most, I would say, very harsh conditions, and the great creativity, ingenuity we had, and most importantly, devotion to our people. While today I think we still have that creativity, as Brother Darrell just stated, and to a lesser degree, we had a devotion to freedom of the collective. We got it. Is it here? But I think it's harder to find. Like what you were saying, it's, you know, you just don't see it no more. You know, but it's there. You know, you just don't see it that often. Well, back then you could trip over it more regularly. You know. You know, because, you know, you hear the discourse, you hear people talking. They think we've made it, you know.
Right. And that's the part to me.
No, yeah, as far as I'm concerned, we haven't done anything as a people, especially our generation, when you compare, you know, kind of our accomplishments and our progress as compared to what the folks in the books. We got a lot more work to do, and that was also one of my points of kind of putting the book together to say, hey, no matter where you are in society, I don't care how many, you know, degrees you got or what business you got or how much money you make, you haven't done nothing. I mean, pull up the story of John Barry Meacham, and you know, you compare notes to what he did compared to what you did, you haven't done anything. You got more work to do, and I agree with that, you know, wholeheartedly, but I also agree that we are out here working. I mean, even if it's just of yourself in the form of your show, you know, myself in the form of my book, is Dr. Umar Abdullah Johnson. You know, he does excellent work out there. There's plenty of us out there still working and still striving, and hopefully, like I said, some, you know, young brother or sister, whoever, you know, 100 years from now will, you know, document our stories and document the fact that, you know, you had this show and I had this book. And, you know, Minister Farrakhan does the work that he do, et cetera, et cetera, and make sure that kind of our stories get promoted down the line and that history continues on. But, and you know, like I said, just because it's not prominent, it's not talked about in the news, people tend to focus on the negative. So, you know, sometimes it's not even talked about a lot amongst ourselves, but I do believe that it absolutely exists.
Right.
Exactly. And we thank you for preserving that record and preserving that memory to inspire, you know, future generations untold. And we thank you for joining us, Brother Darrell. And, you know, next time, you know, you have some other projects, feel free to, you know, reach out to us, and we'd love to talk about it.
Thank you, brother. I appreciate it. I appreciate your meeting and everything, and you and Sister Jolivet are doing. You're doing excellent work. Please keep it up. And, you know, just one last time, just want to remind folks, Slaves of Swag, The Negro's Your History Teacher forgot to mention. They can get it at Amazon, Barnes & Noble, or you can go directly to his website, laserswag.com.
And also you have a Facebook community page, or is that your personal page?
Nope, yep, I have a Facebook community page, and also I have a personal page, Darrell T. Hemming. You can look me up on either or. I always love to interact with the readers.
What's the address to your Facebook community page?
It's facebook.com/laserswag.
All right. I will share that on the page, also in the chat room for those listening. All right. And thank you again for sharing with us tonight. And in the future, our normal broadcast is every Wednesday evening at 10 p.m., actually Wednesday night at 10 p.m. Central Standard Time. And so join us anytime.
Yes, ma'am. Thank you very much. And thank you, brother.
All right. Thank you for being with us tonight.
Thank you.
Good night.
Good night.
Night.
We're going to take a quick, brief break, and then we're going to come back, and we're going to start the regular book club broadcast with the slave narratives. So just give us about 2 minutes and we'll be right back. Okay?
there's a fine line. But baby, I'm on it.
There's a fine line between love and hate. You see, can't wait too late, but baby, I'm on it.
Lockdowns and burials. The seeds that sow get devoured by the same locusts. cause it's a hard road to hoe. If your ass don't move and the rain don't fall and the ground is dry, but the roots are strong, so some survive. To your surprise, now I voice their cries. You got more juice than Zeus, slinging lightning, trying to frighten flames dwellers of the Serengeti, but get beheaded when you foster dreaded. Melanin, silicone, and collagen injected. Dissecting my pride, who the one gonna get it started? We be the lion hearted, without infanticide. It's like that red sprite, you can't imagine. Unless you're looking at the canvas of life, not through the peephole of mortality. Single minded mentality, getting over on loopholes, getting paid twofold on technicalities. Clicking your heels, scared to voice how you feel, packing steel. Picking cotton from the killing fields with no total. I don't think we in Kansas, no moto. Midwest or dirty south, clean dress or dirty mouth.
Welcome back. Thank you for waiting for our brief intermission. That was a great broadcast. The interview there with
Daryl T. Hemming.
Daryl Hemming. Yeah, thank you for rescuing me because I was like Daryl. Yeah, that was a really great interview, the discussion that you had there about his work. And so, how do you feel? How do you feel about that?
Oh, it was awesome. You know, it helps, you know, to, you know, get resources like these and see, you know, what was really going on. Because I've done a little genealogical research, you know, not much, and to see some of the things that he collected from the Census Bureau and other resources was inspiring. And to see what kind of, you know, stories you can find in the lives of people, you know, who were long forgotten. Many of our ancestors, we don't remember. We don't know their story. What kind of obstacles they had to overcome that could be similar to these stories that found it within the this monograph he put together, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, this is great, and, you know, I think we all should delve into our own past as well, you know, our own family trees.
Mm-hmm.
See, we can find great heroic narratives like these presented here. But
all right, so
back to the great Frederick Douglass.
The great Frederick Douglass. All right, so we're going to transition right into our regular weekly book club meeting, and we are discussing the book, The Slave Narratives. I'm going to get a link for it now and put it in the chat room. It is the Slave Narratives. This particular one is called The Narrative of the Life of Frederick Douglass, is it?
Yes.
Yeah.
There you go. There you go. You know, I usually discuss these chapters in the sequence as presented by Frederick Douglass.
Mm-hmm.
But in this particular case, I want to open with the last part of the third chapter.
Okay.
For the express purpose, if people don't tune in, I want them to know that, hey, they need to hear this before they go. They need to really think and meditate on this right here.
Okay.
And I'm going to read not all of it, but yes, I'm most of it.
Okay.
Because it's important to realize how these behaviors right here really are still with us today.
Okay.
And
what part you're about to read?
The last part of chapter 3.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, let's hit it. I'm ready. Let's do it.
Here you go. He says, "Moreover, slaves are like other people and imbibe prejudices quite common to others. They think of their own better than that of others. Many under the influence of this prejudice think of their own masters better than the masters of other slaves. And this, too, in some cases, when the very reverse is true. Indeed, it is not uncommon for slaves even to fall out and quarrel among themselves about the relative goodness of their masters,
mm-hmm.
each contending for the superior goodness of his own over that of the others.
Mm-hmm.
At the very same time, they mutually execrate their masters when viewed separately. It was so on our plantation. When Colonel Lloyd's slaves met the slaves of Jacob Jepson, they seldom parted without a quarrel about their masters. Colonel Lloyd's slaves contending that he was the richest, and Mr. Jepson's slaves that he was the smartest and most of a man. Colonel Lloyd's slaves would boast his ability to buy and sell Jacob Jepson. Mr. Jepson's slaves would boast his ability to whip Colonel Lloyd. These quarrels would almost always end in a fight between the parties, and those that whipped were supposed to have gained the point at issue. They seemed to think that the greatness of their masters was transferable to themselves. It was considered as being bad enough to be a slave, but to be a poor man's slave was deemed a disgrace indeed. What you got on that?
Oh, wow. I see. I knew you were going to go that you were going to go there. Okay, so without us actually being in the bitter hour, I'm just going to say that I think it's unfortunate for us that, and I am really interested on, you know, from a psychological perspective to figure out what and how were they able to do this. And because it is, you know, to coin the phrase, pimp tight. We still do that today. They're fighting about whose master is better. I got a good job. My job is better than yours. I drive a better car than yours. I drive a Mercedes. Well, I drive a BMW. I drive a Cadillac.
Right.
Shoes are better than yours because it has these families' names on it. My clothes that are branded, on my butt. These brands, this is better than the brand. Because Gloria Vanderbilt, I think I'm dating myself, can buy and sell Wrangler and
DoorDash or somebody.
DoorDash, right. You know, and it's that insanity has gone nowhere. It's still here. It is still ever present.
Hey.
We'll still fight over who, you know, because until you look at the fact that even though we say that we are free, we are still yet enslaved. And so when we look at these outward manifestations of our enslaved minds and our enslaved thinking, it becomes very sad indeed.
Exactly. I mean, I can get point another dimension is the athletic teams, you know, basketball and football. They have drafts. They're basically slave auctions.
Yeah, yeah.
And
we are gonna win. We
aren't doing anything.
I'm for the, you know, who's gonna win, Grambling or who's in the classic? Grambling and PV.
Others.
Who's gonna win? Is it Grambling or Prairie View? We're gonna win. We.
Well, all things considered, those are HBCUs, but they have become under control of white colleges now.
Prairie View is under the control of A&M, so no, it is not.
But back, I'm just looking back to the professional teams. They have drafted the teams actually owned by way of these contracts over the Negro or African athletes, their slaves. Of the white slave masters,
mm-hmm.
And people, whether they be the team or fans, argue for the wisdom or the, you know, the strength and the just the goodness or the competency of that team. Oh, we got some good slaves. And people, remember, people always talk about Jerry Jones or whatever he's doing. You know, who gives a crap about Jerry Jones? He's a slave master,
right?
No, but.
You can look over at that situation that just happened at that university. Was it Penn State?
Yeah, University of Pennsylvania.
Right. So we can look at how, you know, we're being bought and sold. You know, it's really kind of obvious. But for some, I know that is a difficult pill because we want to believe that we are not, still under, you know, these people's control and so on and so forth, and we would like to think otherwise, and so these are disturbing ideas and concepts that we would just rather dismiss and say, no, I have all of my freedom, you know, and I dare you to freely move about without the papers that they told you that you had to have. Try to go to another country without, you know, showing, you know, the permission slip that you have to be given, just like in school.
Oh, yeah.
To have a permission slip to walk the halls. You have to have a permission slip to move about this country and to other places. Don't tell me about freedom.
Right. And
tell me about freedom.
If we had to have our manumission papers or some kind of document in this book, Slaves of Sway, it talks about documents that free African Negroes had to have on them at all times.
Right. And we still do. We still have to have our papers.
You got to have your driver's license, identification card. You want to leave the country, you got to have a passport. You get to the next country, you got to have a visa, you know.
So let's not, I mean, we're deluding ourselves, and I think that until you realize your condition, then you can never escape it. And that's what I was kind of getting at with the author that we were talking to, is that I think that a lot of the, a lot of the fire, that fire, that's what I was talking about. Because I think, and the reason I think it's very simple, and maybe I should have articulated myself a little bit better when I was talking to him, but what I was trying to say is that those people, they knew that they were enslaved because they had to slice off the bond, the chain,
right,
to walk free, to get away. They understood the concept of escaping, getting away from you, cut off these shackles, please, so that I might go. So there was no question as to what degree of freedom, how free, I'm a little free, I'm more free than I had been before, all of these things. No, it was I am enslaved and I want to get free. Now it's the waters are muddied.
Right, right, because, see, like we talked about when we had Ezra Aharon on the African Conversation Program, was about the issue about sovereignty. We lost sovereignty when we were captured and brought on the ships to the Americas.
Right.
So now then it became from abject, you know, personal private property of an individual or European person to property of the federal government.
The corporations in the state,
right,
is the same.
And so now we haven't thought about our own sovereignty independent of these people.
Right.
So we still on the plantation talking about the various freedoms and rights that we want to enjoy.
Right. And that we should go to them and petition them for more rights because they are the sole, you know, arbiters and the holders of all rights, all privileges and all everything, you know, and it's just disheartening. But this is not Bitter Hour. Brother Amin is on the line. Welcome tonight. We kept losing your call. Is everything okay?
Hello, can you hear me?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Hey, welcome.
Yeah, everything's fine. How's it going?
Good, good, good.
Hey, what's up?
You missed the first hour. We had a really great author on. He was talking about his book. It's called Slaves with Swag, and it was very interesting speaking with him. But anyway, and so Charles was just reading the second part of the third chapter for us. And, yeah, so I think that what I was trying to get across to him, and I think it's maybe we didn't understand each other, or perhaps he didn't understand, I wasn't making myself clear, is that I was saying that because the waters are muddied, we don't, just even that type of ingenuity, we would say that was extreme.
Right.
You know, today, we would say that's extreme. We don't have to do that, you know, because we live in a free, you know, free country, and, you know, that, as a matter of fact, they would deem that, you know, that's, those are terroristic things, activities, you know. But,
right,
you know, that was about survival, and that was about getting free. They were serious about getting free.
I'm going to say we had more, I would say we were treated with more respect by the constables or sheriffs then than now. I was reading in this book, when Frederick was arrested by the constable for a plan to escape,
mm-hmm,
the police asked them to extend their arms to you know, so they can tie them, their hands.
Mm-hmm.
And one of Frederick's companions said he wasn't going to do it.
Mm-hmm.
Now, they didn't hit him over the head with a club and put their foot on his neck like you've seen pictures and beat him, you know, like we've seen, you know, countless times, you know. They didn't, no, the guy, the consul pulled a gun on him and said, you won't do my blow. He said, hey, go ahead and shoot because I can only die once.
Yeah.
Because they knew this man had dignity and they weren't going to try to disrespect his dignity because they knew he was willing to die for it.
Right.
You see what I'm saying? But today, they wouldn't kill you. They would try to just harm you just so you can survive the indignity.
Right.
You know what I'm saying? We are being humiliated to a greater degree than we were 150 years ago. And we don't even know it because we have so many comforts now.
Right.
You know, so to see somebody of our nation to be humiliated in, you know, print or on television or in media, just as for our entertainment nowadays, we say, hey, that's a price we're willing to pay to eat, you know, eat a big steak at the steakhouse, you know what I'm saying, with white folks, you know, because we count it as a privilege to not have our own or to not be able to support and protect our interests globally. We have to look at our homeland, Africa, be ravaged, raped by the same people that raped and ravaged and harvested us and brought us here, and we got to stand by and watch.
Right.
It's like, how you want to watch? It's like watching your parents get raped and learning to, you know, not feel anything.
Right.
And, you know, that's why we have a lot of, you know, emotional problems as a people. You know, that
that depends on what my parents did wrong.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, some people might say, you know, they might have had that coming, you know. Yeah, they're probably into it, yeah.
That is scary on so many levels.
And I've heard you talk about that before, Charles. You said, you know, with these folks, they come on TV and they tell us, turn yourself in.
Oh, yeah.
They going to take care of you.
Yeah, I've heard that a lot. People, right, they turn yourself in. What? One day, we hear about a story in Houston. Brother had, did something, and mama made him go to the police station or something.
Yeah.
Some.
Or even the young lady who accidentally, she was babysitting, remember? This was last summer, and she was babysitting, and she left the house to run to the store and left the kids at home. And the kids did something and tried to cook or something and set the house on fire. Anyway, several of the children were hurt. I don't think anybody was killed. But anyway, whatever the situation was, she was from Nigeria, I believe it was.
Nigeria, yeah.
Yeah, and she left the country, and they couldn't find her. They sent people over and, you know, to look for her and this and the other. You know how they got her? Her mom told her to turn herself in, and she did.
Man, we got to stop doing that. Stop going to jail.
You know, and I know people will say, well, you know, she did something wrong and this and the other, but here's the deal.
Get out of jail.
The situation, right, there needs to be a payment. She needs to pay for what she's done, but she shouldn't have to pay them.
Right, because that's who profits from that incarceration is. It's their system. We're not saying that. Because some people can count it as though, see, they look at it as though the European is judge.
Right, and that is not the case.
That's, you know, that's the only way. And if that can't be done, well, look at all the crimes they get away with. Who's judging them? Who's going to judge them or condemn them, rather?
Right. Who's going to condemn them?
Who's going to condemn them? It ain't through me.
We just saw that. That was less than a year ago. You had a guy, American contractor. He's over in Pakistan. He said these two guys trying to rob him, and he shot him in the back. And what they said is you don't. What they said to Pakistan is you do not have the authority to prosecute this man. We have the authority to pass judgment on him, but you do not have the authority. Pakistan turned him in, and he was walking around free here.
Right. Right.
See, so with two people dead over in another country, their lives meant absolutely nothing. Compared to that white guy's life.
Right. Pakistan made their deal with the devil. That's how they got the nuke. And so Charlie say, give me my brother back, my kinsman back. They say, yeah, it's a boss.
Right.
See, if you don't understand the geopolitics, you want to know why they clicking their heels like that? That's why. You know what I'm saying? Now, somebody had got them. I think it was Afghanistan some years back. I think this was back in early this decade, the late 90s. Some so-called missionaries, you know, they spooks, was over there, and they busted them. They was going to execute them. I don't know, you might remember this story. They were supposed to be Christian missionaries over in Afghanistan or somewhere. I think that's where it was.
Oh yeah.
And they were finna, they were finna put them out their misery.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they had this big thing. They were saying, oh, we can't let these people condemn us, you know. And they had it all in the news, beating the drums for war, because they don't want melanated people showing
any dominance whatsoever.
No dominance, not even in your own house. You understand it?
In your own home.
Like the whole globe, they're trying to turn it into their own plantation. Even when they absent, they want to be running it without even having to be there. That's how deep it is. Autopilot, man. They going deep with this here. Y'all, man, this is a nightmare spread. Now, he talked about, now just to back up into the chapter a little bit more, he talks about how in slavers, these basically they kidnap and murder and rapists like to have a high, reputation of themselves, and they want us to have it of them too. And so in this third paragraph on in the page 23, he said, it is partly the consequence of such facts that slaves, when inquired as to their condition and the character of their masters, almost universally say they are contented and that their masters are kind. The slaveholders have been known to send spies in among their slaves to ascertain their views and feelings in regard to their condition. The frequency of this has had the effect to establish among slaves the maxim that a still tongue makes a wise head. They suppress the truth rather than take the consequences of telling it, and in doing so, prove themselves a part of the human family. If they have anything to say of their masters, it is generally in their master's favor, especially when speaking to an untried man.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and so that's the thing. You know, basically, you got to know who you're talking to.
Right.
And it was like that then, and it's like that now. We talk about going on our job, complaining about the supervisor or manager or some kind of wrong that's been happening, worried about somebody going and running, telling, spying back to supervisor and him setting you up, framing you for some error or something, or even magnifying something that went wrong on the job and making a mountain out of a molehill. You know, all of these tactics that we experience in our occupations, going to work for this other nation, we have to endure this whole slave, this whole process of maintaining basically our compliance. They have to maintain our compliance. We have to pretend that we think highly of them than they deserve to be regarded. And though it be a lie, they don't want it to be said that they're anything less than that. And I think that's a very important lesson that we must learn consciously. I think unconsciously we all know it, but we have to put it into the front of our minds so we can be, you know, more sensitive in a way too, so we can properly change some things, and we can start altering our environment. What y'all got to say on that?
I agree.
Well, you know what I'm going to say? as far as that being a practice going on now, to send somebody to spy, I know that for a fact from work.
Right.
You know, that this is going on, you know.
Right.
And a lot of folks do.
You go ahead.
Yeah, I was saying a lot of folks don't realize this is going on at this moment. There's a whole industry made out of that.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
You know, that's Brother Steve Coakley said, late Steve Coakley said before he passed, I remember sometime he said, the most humiliating thing we do every day is go to work. And he wasn't meaning like getting up out of bed, going to work. He was talking about the kind of psychological trauma we have to endure to make a living,
mm-hmm.
is the humiliation. That is the trauma, the humiliation, the lack of the true respect, the false patronizing respect. We have to take it, because we know if they don't give us that, we haven't put ourselves in any better position to gain otherwise. And that's the humiliating thing that we go through in order to, to meet our needs, to maintain ourselves. And until we actually construct an economy and figure out how we're going to protect it, you know, we will have to continue to endure to varying degrees that same humiliation. And that's the sad truth of the matter. And another thing, this is the beginning of the chapter, though it may not be quite invigorating, but backtracking through it, because we worked this chapter from the end to the front this time. Frederick Douglass mentions this is his father, Colonel Lloyd. He's the head planter in this county, and he mentions a garden that this man has, that this kidnapping, murder, and rapist has, and he describes how amazing it is, and how he's starving people on this same farm he has working for him, you know, sun to sundown, and then he has this like renowned garden. I'm gonna read a little bit about it and what's going on surrounding this garden. He says, Colonel Lloyd kept a large and finely cultivated garden, which afforded almost constant employment for four men, besides the chief gardener. This garden was probably the greatest attraction of the place. During the summer months, people came from far and near, from Baltimore, Easton, and Annapolis, to see it. It abounded in fruits of almost every description, from the hearty apple of the north to the delicate orange of the south. This garden was not the least source of trouble on the plantation. Its excellent fruit was quite a temptation to the hungry swarms of boys, as well as the older slaves belonging to the colonel, few of whom had the virtue or the vice to resist it. Scarcely a day passed during the summer but that some slave had to take the lash for stealing fruit. Stealing. Ain't that something? The colonel had to resort to all kinds of stratagems to keep the slaves out of the garden. The last and most successful one was that of tarring his fence all around, after which, if a slave was caught with any of the tar upon his person, it was deemed sufficient proof that he had either been into the garden or had tried to get in. In either case, he was severely whipped by the chief gardener. This plan worked well. The slaves became fearful of tar as of the lash. They seemed to realize the impossibility of touching tar without being defiled. Now, see. Now, here he has a guard. He had these people he didn't kidnap and bought from his fellow brethren.
Mm-hmm.
And while he's starving them, he has this wonderful, you know, garden, and he tortures people with the food, torments them by having to smell the food and walk by and look at it, and whom he has afflicted with hunger. And then once they have if they don't have the vice to resist it, meaning you know, he's basically saying that it's got to be a vice to not, you know, satisfy your human instinct to feed yourself, to not go into that garden and take a piece of fruit and having it considered theft,
mm-hmm.
and being subject to the cruelty of the lash. And this is no different today's bank. Ready to put the dye bag, the little dye bomb in the bag of money. If you know someone has heard about, you know, when bank robbers steal, rob a bank and they put a dye bomb and then you get this ink all over you. And I'm pretty sure there are other similar stratagems to mark someone who has taken back something that was really originally stolen property. So, you know, basically, we are stolen property, and really anything we take can only be considered forced reparations. And I'd just like to leave that note. You have anything to say about that? Anybody else have anything? Yeah, same brother me.
Oh yeah, I just thought that was interesting. You know, they these people are stolen, and he's condemning them for stealing.
Yeah. The irony. That's scary. And you know what? That kind of thinking, that's not different. That's not different from right now.
Right.
That's not different from right now. All of the things that they try and condemn, you know, with their moral, you know, diatribes about being right and actually having the nerve to try and establish what right and wrong should be for anybody.
Yeah, they try to have them make themselves the moral authority.
You know, but
anybody.
That commercial, Charles, that you saw, it says something about they establish what is normal.
Yeah, yeah.
What was it? It was something.
I don't know what that is they're talking about.
Came on one day, and Charles just said, what the? You know, on some commercial, they were saying, we tell you what is normal.
Right, we redefine normal. And I'm like,
normal or something. Really? You know, they have become so brazen.
Right. I know y'all doing it, but y'all just gonna tell me now on the TV. Okay.
Out of their minds. You know, with that evil. I'm telling you, evil. They tell you all the time on these different shows and stuff where, you know, Dr. Evil always loses his mind. You know, he just becomes so insane with evil.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, tell you, I know,
that's,
you know,
that's really similar with marketing. You know, Amos Wilson talks a lot about that. That they market, they tell us what our desires are.
Yeah.
And then prosecute us for stealing because we don't have enough money to get what they told us our desires were.
Right. You told me what I wanted, and then you outpriced me on it, so I can't afford it. Right. And then get angry, you know, and want to prosecute me because I'm trying to get what you told me that I should want.
But then they impoverished me.
Right. And then it impoverished me. Right. Oh, man.
Yeah. They impoverished me. They keep me poor. They take away. They obstruct my ability, interfere with my ability to have economic success. You know, like I was reading in whose book I was reading? I'm reading somebody's book. They were talking about fine clothes, expensive clothes. I think this is book Slave and Swag. They had a law that African Negro could not wear silk.
Oh, wow.
Because black folks was making so much money, even in slavery, that we was buying fine clothes.
Mm-hmm.
And the white folks was mad because they felt that the Negroes was dressing better than them.
Mm.
But they wanted to put a cap on and make sure, okay, he cannot wear silk. It write your ticket.
Mm.
You know?
Just like those new shoes. You remember you talking about, what's her name?
Yeah, Harriet Jacobs.
Jacobs, right. Wore those new shoes, and her mistress told her that was just too much. They made too much noise.
Yeah, forbade from wearing them ever again.
And right.
You know. And so that's why I think as a culture, we are obsessed with clothes. I think, you know, because we had to wear that uniform made of that coarse, what you call Negro fabric, I think we read in previous episodes. And then I think when we were able to get, you know, buy some more comfortable, desirable fabrics and shoes and things, you know, what we right for, yeah, we need gear, you know, footwear and all that good stuff. But, you know, in our new condition, we've somehow become obsessed with it. And we've taken it to some other place where it probably, you know, shouldn't be, you know. And instead, we should be making, instead of making our own clothes, because we did make our own shoes, we were making fabrics in those days. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
We were doing it. So for us to wear nice fabrics and nothing wasn't a problem. For our own economy. We could dress nice and still support our own economy. Today, that's not the case. We're supporting their economy when we're dressing nice. So what would have been a blessing for us in 18 in the 19th century is a curse for us in the later 20th and 21st century.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I'm saying? Because we don't know how to use it where our ancestors did.
Right.
No, right on. I know everybody's got something else to do tonight.
I know. We're going to go.
We ain't going to tie y'all up any more than we have. We thank you for joining us and coming out to listen to us discuss Slaves with Swag, the Negroes, your history teacher forgot to mention, and our regular weekly feature, The Life of the Narrative of a Slave, Frederick Douglass, written by himself, in the Slave Narrative series published by the Library of America and edited by Henry Gates. And I think it's the other guy's name is William L. Andrews. And we thank you and join us again next week where we'll continue on to the fourth chapter of Frederick Douglass' autobiography.
All right. Peace.
Peace. Y'all have a good night.
Good night.